Welcome to the Teletext R podcast. Today, we tell the tale of the CFEX striker, Roy S.N. Doe.
My agent saw the Wickham site on CFEX, and obviously with their injuries and everything and me not being cup-tied, he got on the phone to Laurie Chancellor's and they had a chat, and he asked me to come down and play a couple of reserve games.
With their secret CFAX striker on the bench, Wickham travelled to Filbert Street to take on high-flying Leicester City in their quarter-final.
Paul McCarthy gave Wickham the lead before Muzzy Izzet equalised for Leicester. With 20 minutes to go, Eason Doe's moment had arrived.
As CFAX substitute striker Roy S.N. Doe took up a position in the box, his gaffer Sanchez ended up watching his team on one.
Back by Bates. Esendo! It's in! They found through an advert on the internet. Has really put Wickham on the world wide map. You couldn't make it up. You really couldn't.
And Roy S.N. Doe has stepped from obscurity into international headlines.
It's one of the most iconic moments in FA Cup history. Roy S.N. Doe leaping to score a last-minute goal against Leicester and earn Division 2 Wickham Wanderers a place in the semi-finals of England's most prestigious cup competition. The CFEX striker, as he has been dubbed, signed for injury-stricken Wickham after his agent spotted a story about the club's plight on the BBC's Teletext service. And to celebrate the 20th anniversary of S.N. Doe's heroics, today I am joined by Paul Lewis, operator of the official Wickham website at the time and the current owner of the Cherboys Wickham fan site. So how are you today, Paul?
Very good. Hi, Dan. Thanks for inviting us on.
No problem. It's fantastic to have you here and to hear your expertise on this subject. On this podcast, usually, we ask our guests what their Teletext history is. So I'm going to ask that to you. What is your own personal involvement with Teletext? Did you use it?
I think like a lot of fans of football clubs, you're just dying to get any snippet of information on your club. And probably the lower you go down the divisions, the more you have to search for it. So being a Wickham Wanderers fan who's come up from non-league football, it was a useful source of results. You know, we were not generally covered even on the pools. So you sometimes were waiting to get results on a midweek game. You'd wait for Teletext to pop up and you'd dial in the page number, whatever that was. So it was just another resource before the internet popped up in the mid-1990s. Not just football either. I mean, it's all, as you know, all manners of subjects. My other passion is music. So you're looking on there for gig listings and et cetera, you know. It's nostalgic times.
Did you ever correspond via Teletext? Did you ever send anything to any of the Teletext sections?
Not myself, no. I knew there was some sort of music-related input from local people, but I didn't do it myself. Just generally a reader, right through to like the early days of the internet. I mean, I was online doing the Wickham website 1995. So, I mean, the website that I've been running has been on over 25 years. And eventually you could get TV cards for your desktop. And some of those had Teletext built in. So you could find information on that as well. So it was before the internet was used in such a way that you could find results so quickly. And now it's with, you know, mobile technology has completely changed the way the internet operated. But, you know, you go back to the times we're talking about, to the, you know, the famous S.N. Doe goal, where it was just dial-up connections. You know, you couldn't get the internet on a mobile phone. That changed the face of the internet. And that was probably the, sadly for you, you know, the enthusiasts of Teletext and CFAX, that was the demise of the service. You can't compete with that sort of technology.
Yeah, I think the incident we're going to discuss today is during a time period when teletext and the internet overlapped in their usage, where they, well, maybe teletext, it was its swan song. It was the last time where CFAX dominated over the internet. But what I'd like to ask is, you said you've been running your fan site, or you've been running websites since 1995. How did you get into that? How did you get into running websites?
It was really because you could do it. You know, you brought a magazine with, I guess people started buying PCs around that time, 1995, you know, Windows 95, I suppose. Yeah. Judging by the date. And you could get on the internet with some slow dial-up device, and certain internet providers gave you some web space, so you could create your own website. But before that, I think this, you know, there was a big student base. So there's some of the early internet sites run by enthusiasts of football clubs. You know, if you want to go down that path, were generally hosted at educational establishments. So when it became possible to get on the internet, it was just, yeah, I can do this. I can write half a dozen pages. Look, this, we're Wycombe Wanderers. Here's a list of fixtures. Here's some results. And it just built from there, really. And it took quite a while. I mean, it was, you know, you'd struggle to find other people on the internet. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just, you know, probably of a fan base of, I don't know, Wycombe's crowds then were sort of 4,000 or 5,000. I'm guessing, just off the top of my head, there's probably only 5% of them on the internet at the time. But, you know, now you'd say it's near 100%.
Yes, absolutely. We've come a long way since those days. How long has it been? 25 years? Teletext fading out and the internet taking over. But did you have a PC at home that you worked on the websites with? Or did you do it, say, at an educational institute or a library?
No, it was a home PC. I think it was brought from Time Computers. If you're old enough to remember that, you'd look in a computer magazine, say you wanted that one, phone them up, buy it over the internet, and a few weeks later a box would turn up and you'd be probably about £2,000 less rich. And
oh dear.
Away you went, and the slowest internet connection you could ever imagine. You know, it was so slow, you couldn't even begin to explain. You just thought it was normal at the time, so you didn't think anything of it. I mean, the broadband connections and Wi-Fi connections changed everything. I mean, the official website started at Wycombe Wanderers, I guess, a similar time to a lot of other clubs, you know, around that time. So the Wycombe official website started, I believe, in 1997. Most teams had an official website. It was usually run by someone perhaps connected with the club with a IT background, because they had the know-how to be able to upload a few basic web pages. But there was nothing really that sophisticated about any of the official websites at the time, unless clubs could chuck thousands of pounds at it, because it was seen to be a sort of a dark art of creating a website, wherein probably, in fact, it was relatively simple.
Do you think that was the case, chucking thousands of pounds at it for the Wycombe site? How did you come to be involved with the official Wycombe Wanderers site?
Yeah, well, because I was running the independent site, and I could, you know, if you like, put my enthusiasm behind it and update it in my own time, add to it from a fan's point of view. And we had a forum behind the scenes as well. So you're getting a lot of, you know, I think the interaction on websites make websites. If you just sat there uploading information, you don't get any feedback. You think, is anybody looking at this? Is there any point in doing it? But once you've got some sort of interaction, it gives you the emphasis to move on and create more content. So the Chairboys site, that's chairboys.co.uk, is the website that I've been running for 25 years. I think that domain name was taken out late 90s, was popular with the fans, and the official site was sort of running parallel with that. And then by chance, someone volunteered myself, you know, Paul will help them out. I said yes. You know, they said, oh yeah, we're asked full to do that. And I came along halfway through the 1999-2000 season, tidied up the website, relaunched it around sort of January 2000, and used the technology that was available at the time to make it as up to date as possible, which in those days meant taking a laptop to an away game. This sounds all very sort of, wow, that's not amazing at all. But trust me, back then, a laptop to an away game and being able to connect to the internet was not easy. You had no broadband. There was no Wi-Fi. There was probably, at some clubs, you'd have two or three phone sockets at the level we're playing at to try and plug into. If you didn't have that, I was relying on a mobile phone with a built-in modem. So it was cutting-edge technology at the time, but we managed to get reports up on the final whistle. So, I mean, that was the benefit of doing it that way. So, you know, we not led the way, but for a club of Wickham's size, we went from a site that was updated perhaps on a Monday when someone was back in the office to match reports that are uploaded within 15 minutes of the final whistle.
I can just imagine you're sitting next to the phone socket, beeping away, thinking, come on, upload, upload. Yeah. I need to get this uploaded before, I don't know, what would have been the rival at the time? BBC News, I guess, before the main news sites.
Yeah, I don't think it was any like, I don't think you ever saw it as a rival to yourselves, because they're sitting there with a teleprinter, whatever you want to call it, input. But, you know, we would add our own personal touch, someone who was at the game, someone who could see what was happening in front of us and giving a sort of personal touch to reports, you know. So it's, you can't beat that, being at the games.
Did you ever talk to anybody who was sort of a correspondent for the teleprinter? How did that work? Do you know?
When I was reporting from away games, there was often be a correspondent there who worked for the press association, which then I guess syndicated the information back for the teleprinter. They would have booked a phone line for the entire game and used up one of those phone lines, those valuable phone lines. And they would be on the phone the whole game, and they would be talking what was happening on the pitch, but in the form of a sort of a grid, if you like, or where, you know, left channel, right channel, players' names. It was not a commentary as such, but it was obviously some on the other end feeding in stats, which I guess is what's happened nowadays, where the game is completely overloaded with statistics of someone sitting there and looking at someone, so many passes and the possession rate. And that was where it started from in the 2000, early 2000s. And yeah, if there was a goal, it would be as quick as they could, they would get a goal through, and it would be who scored it and what the minute was. And then, you know, within 30 seconds or so, it would become up on the teleprinter on the BBC final score screen that was sitting alongside. So yeah, that was all over the telephone in those days.
I never thought exactly how it would work, because I know in the really olden days of radio, that's how they would do commentary, because yeah, they'd have one guy basically reading code, as you said, and another guy commentating on the game. And people would follow along with a grid printed out at home.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that was really cool. So maybe they're still doing that these days. Maybe they're still using those codes to report back to the statistics companies, to Opta, saying G3 Johnson pass to G4. Like a chess match or something.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, you would hope they'd probably go down a more technically advanced route. I mean, there's a lot of GPS stuff out there nowadays. You know, all the players are generally wearing GPS vests, even at Wickham's level. We'll say Wickham's level. We're at level 2 now, which is amazing. But, you know, even in the third and fourth tier, most teams are wearing that sort of technology, so they can analyse, you know, where players have been, how far they've run, and they can play back how many yards, you know, meters they've run, etc. And I'm sure they could, yeah, I'm sure they use that sort of technology. But yeah, there is someone definitely sat there at some point determining whether there's a a throw on being taken in the first 5 minutes, because you know a lot of it's obviously linked to the betting industry as well.
Well, on that subject, I just have to say, hopefully it's not the same person who's pressing the button for the fake crowd noise, because they're really, really slow sometimes. But yeah. That's a whole other area. So, as this podcast is uploaded, it's been approximately 20 years to the day, let's say, since Roy Essendo hit the headlines. Sorry, is it Essendo or Essendo?
Well, to tell you the truth, I prefer Essendo. Pretty sure that's correct, but Essendo was one of the BBC commentaries, but the fact that he played so little was probably the reason that the pronunciation never got confirmed. But I prefer Essendo.
Yeah. Well, I've been using Essendo up to now, so I'll continue with that. But yeah, I used to enjoy Tony Gubber's pronunciation of Peter und Löw.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, Tony Gubber commentated on the BBC version of that game that evening on Match of the Day. So that's where the Essendo come from.
Right.
Roy Essendo was on trial at Rushden & Diamonds after 2 years football in Austria and Finland. Luckily, he had a good agent.
It's his job to know what's going on in football, and he knew the situation was going on at Wickham at the time, and he contacted them and got back to me. But it was basically him who got it fixed up for me to go there.
There is an oft-used saying in football, the magic of the FA Cup. And I feel like that phrase was invented for things like this. In storytelling, there's an archetypal underdog story, you know, like Rocky Balboa, Oliver Twist, or even Frodo Baggins. So, Paul, exactly how does this, the Essendo heroics, how do they rank in Wickham Wanderers folklore? Is it going to be, in your opinion, a club legend that's remembered forever?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, you have to remember that Wickham Wanderers were a non-league team just 7 years previous and had never even gone beyond the third round of the FA Cup prior to that season, 2000-2001, had never scored in the third round. I think they'd played possibly three or four times in the FA Cup third round prior to that, and we'd sort of, I wouldn't say muddled our way through, but we'd got through with replays against Millwall, and then the excitement of reaching the third round, we'd got drawn at home to Grimsby. We battled to a draw at home, beat them away, and got into the fourth round for the first time ever. So it's well documented. We managed to get through against Wolves and Wimbledon in a fantastic replay at Selhurst Park against Wimbledon. And to turn up at Leicester in the sixth round was just surreal, but it tied in with some fairly severe injury problems at the time for Wickham's strikers. So we had up to sort of, whether you call them all strikers, but we certainly had three or four key strikers out. So we had Andy Rammell out, Sean Devine had been out for long term. Andy Baird, another one of our strikers, had been injured in the Wimbledon game. So we were running on sort of thin air, really. So, yeah, it was an incredible moment when someone who had literally just turned up on trial came on in the last, I don't know, 15 minutes or so. And you thought, oh, well, you know, we're hang out for a draw here. He pops up and scores, you know, think, wow, hold on, we're in the semi-finals here. It'll never be forgotten. I mean, it probably, I don't know where you'd rank it, but it's not the greatest moment, but it's in the top one, as Brian Clough would say.
Those score lines that you quoted just now in the previous rounds, do you have them embedded into your brain, embedded into your memory forever?
Yeah. They are embedded in my brain, but I have perhaps the exact details of of who scored might need a bit of memory jogging, but I'd be impressed if everyone could remember who scored all the goals at Selhurst Park in a replay, which earned us, because it ended 2-2 after extra time when we scored in the 123rd minute or something like that to equalise by Paul McCarthy, who's sadly no longer with us. And it went to a shootout and both teams were down to 10 men. And there was 20 penalties.
Ooh.
Each side had a chance to win it before Wickham eventually won it. You think, oh, well, that's it. We've missed one. They're going to take one. And if someone could come up and name all the penalty takers of that, I really would be impressed without having to refer to any notes. But
well, don't worry. I'm not going to ask you to do that.
All I can remember is a Wimbledon player just blasting the ball over the crossbar and staring in amazement out of the press box at Selhurst Park and think, my God, we won this somehow. And it was very late on at night as well, because it was, you know, we're in South London and time was ticking on. You know, it was probably well gone 10 o'clock. And you said, oh, I've got to get a train back somehow. And when seeing the Wickham fans the other side of the pitch, you know, there's another advantage of being in a press box was, yeah, you miss being amongst the fans, but you could see the fans celebrating as well, which was a unique experience for myself, where you could not just see them, but you could, in a position where you could hear the noise of that isolated section of fans just cheering at a goal and celebrating at the final whistle.
Williams will take the kick. And he skied it! Wickham Wanderers are in the quarter-final of the FA Cup in an unbelievable story here at Selhurst Park. 2-0 down in the first game, 1-0 down and 2-1 down tonight. They've scored an equaliser in the dying moments of the game. And now from the penalty spot, Wickham Wanderers have done it. And a team that had never been into the third round of the FA Cup before are now in the quarterfinals.
The story goes that Laurie Sanchez did post a striker wanted advert on the Wickham website when, as you say, Wickham were terribly injury hit. So, do you remember or do you know if that was exclusively Laurie Sanchez's idea or the result of a brainstorming session with many others? And I guess, were you involved in that or how were you involved if you were?
Well, there's a bit of a story behind that one. It was not a brainstorming session. Laurie Sanchez, they were getting desperate. They were looking for players all over the place. I mean, I think they approached Ian Wright and Gianluca Vialli as well. I think Ian Wright was injured and Vialli was asking too much money. So they Wickham needed to find strikers who were, one, fit, two, not cup-tied. And obviously in Wickham's case, didn't want, you know, £10,000 a week just to play in a FA Cup game. And they needed to be signed by a deadline. They can't just sign in the week before the game. They had to be signed, I think, a couple of weeks beforehand. So it was getting desperate. And I think the way the story panned out was that Laurie Sanchez was talking to our press officer at the time, Alan Hutchinson, and sort of joked, or we could put something on teletext. And I think Alan had some connections with teletext. And I think one evening this story just popped up. I think it was towards the end of February 2001. If you can find this story, if you could find a screenshot of this, it would be amazing. Because I can sort of picture it. Because to come back to your other point, it was never on the Wickham website.
Oh,
it was
right.
100%, I can tell you that, because I was running it. The website was run by the, if you like, the sales and marketing team. So they were behind the website. So they were the people who brought me in, volunteered. I was only doing it voluntary. It was just in my spare time. So I was just helping the club out. And the press officer at the time working full-time for the club. So there was a little bit of internal rivalry. I mean, I got on with both of them, but I I guess when the sales and marketing meet public relations, they don't necessarily get on as well. So the website was one thing, and the press officer was doing his own thing. Of course, there was club call lines as well at the time. So premium rate phone numbers. So there was a little bit of internal rivalry, if you like. So it wasn't on the website, but once it had gone on to teletext, this story got mentioned on the message board that's associated with the Chairboys site, the Gas Room, as it was called at the time, which is a throwback to our old ground. That's why it's called that. Someone posted up, "Oh, have you seen this small story on teletext? We're searching for a striker," you know, and it's all a bit of a joke, really. You know, Wickham Wanderers searching for a striker. You must be fit. You can't be cup tied. Please contact the club. And it wasn't even a full page. It's one of those teletext pages where there was, you know, maybe two or three stories you could pack into the small space you got available.
Yeah.
It was just a roundup thing. Perhaps I had to scroll through two or three pages to get to it. And people obsessed with news at the time, just trying to find anything related to your club, and found this story, posted it on the message board. And the story goes that Roy Essendo's agent saw this, whether he saw it on the teletext, I'm guessing, someone else told him, but he was the only one, Roy Essendo's agent was the only one to respond to the club and say, "Yeah, look, my player's available. Give him a trial." And Wickham did that. They put him into a reserve game against QPR on a Wednesday afternoon, and he didn't do a lot in that game. But that was enough for Laurie Sanchez to say, "Oh, we're okay, didn't do a lot. We're playing in the home game against Port Vale," which is a week before we played Leicester. To be honest, he didn't do a lot in that either. And he was taken off after sort of 75 minutes. He got another brief run out. We actually played midweek before the Leicester game. We played Reading, and he came on with, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes left. And, you know, you didn't think anything of it. You know, he wasn't like, "Oh, blimey, he looks like he's going to bag the winner against Leicester on Saturday and take us into the semi-finals of the FA Cup." We were looking at damage limitation at that point. You know, Leicester had just done extremely well in Premier League games against Liverpool. Back in the days when Sunderland were in the top division as well, I think they did quite well against them. And there was no expectation from the majority of people going into that game that we'd come out with any sort of result. But I have to say that Laurie Sanchez was so confident going into the game. He had a press conference at the midweek game against Reading where literally every press person appeared in the world turned up to preview this game against Leicester. And they were all packed in his office, and there was cameras everywhere from not just UK or from Scandinavia. And he was just giving a press conference. And he was in his element. He just ended it, "Well, we won't lose Saturday." And he thought, "Oh, wow, you know, we're not going to lose." You know, he was so confident. "We won't lose." You know, perhaps he was going for the draw.
Yeah.
And where other people at the club were saying, "Well, you know, it'd be good if we just perhaps don't lose by too many." There was certain officials at the club were saying to me after the Port Vale game, "What would you give just to lose 3-0? And you know, as an eternal optimist, well, you never know. Anything can happen in football. But, you know, not for a, you know, you go into a game nervous. You just want to do yourself, you know, you just want to be a credit to your club and just battle at the end of the day. So it was, when he signed on trial, no expectations whatsoever. He was on the bench against Leicester, and no one was screaming to bring him on.
I guess that's one of the things, one of the small things that goes into making this such an amazing story, building the legend. But the fifth round tie with Premier League Leicester at their own ground, Filbert Street, was quite an exhilarating one. Were you there in person? I assume you were there in person to report on the game for the website.
I went to every single game that season, home and away, with the trusty laptop and mobile phone, trying to connect to the internet. And yeah, as the games went on, you realise it was sort of chalk and cheese facilities at games. So Grimsby away, sat in a old wooden stand, the little stand. If anyone's been into the press area at Grimsby, it's very low down, and it's you're scrambling around on little desks and trying to find a phone socket. Leicester City at the time, Filbert Street, up in the stands with a, from memory, where I was sat was very similar to the camera angle. So my memories of the game from the press area was very similar to how you'd see it on the TV replays. And you had the luxury then of having a live TV monitor with replays, which I've never experienced that before. So when you're reporting on a game and you're not sure about something, you can see it again on a replay. And that's just taken for granted now.
Yeah.
But you think, blimey, these people have got it easy.
I mean, it was such a luxury.
It was. And like, Wickham, I got into halftime at 0-0. I thought, oh, that's fantastic. We've got to 0-0 at halftime. Doesn't matter what happens now. We've done ourselves, we've done justice here. You know, you're trying to convince yourself, you know, you're happy, but you never know, you might nick one. And again, it's Paul McCarthy popped up and headed us into the lead during the second half. And again, it was coming back to the situation with where I was sat. And it was a sort of a stooping header, and it was a little bit of a debate whether it was an own goal. And you could, you know, watch the replay. Yeah, that's Paul McCarthy's goal, no doubt about it. So that was one of the benefits of being sat up there. And it was it was a massive privilege to be there at the time, to be involved. I was sat quite near the radio commentary as well for the Wickham local radio. And one of our players who was out injured was alongside as well. So we were sort of not next to each other, but sort of diagonally opposite on another row. But we were sort of looking at each other thinking, blimey, you know, we're in the lead here. We could be in the semi-finals. It was just such an amazing experience.
I should imagine it was, yourself being a Wickham Wanderers fan there in the press box and experiencing this, which I assume you'd go on to say was it your most memorable occasion in your history of Wickham Wanderers supporting?
Well, that whole run, you know, if you picked any season, that run to the FA Cup semi-final would be a run that sticks in a lot of people's minds, because it was a run also that brought in a lot of new fans as well, which is always a struggle for any club to get new supporters. So if your team gets to the fifth round of the FA Cup, you're going to start selling tickets. And when we were selling tickets for the fourth round game against Wolves, so that's the first time we ever got to the fourth round, we're thinking at home, capacity of the ground's 10,000. And, you know, we should sell 6,000 or 7,000 for that, no problem. And it's sold out. I mean, it sold out so quickly, you think, blimey, wow. You know, it's 10,000. You know, it was slightly under 10, but it was due to having to juggle around figures to get all the press in. It slightly reduced. So, yeah, I think people will look back on that, on a season where they perhaps started watching Wickham, and it stuck with them over that time. And I think that goes for a lot of clubs. You can always trace back the first time you ever saw a club to a big cup tie. And if you were lucky enough to get tickets for the Leicester game, then that was something you could hang your hat on. I mean, the Wickham had limited tickets for that. Looking at some notes I've got here, I think Wickham had about 3,000 tickets. So not a great deal of tickets compared to who wanted them. But Wickham took the measure also of, because it wasn't on live TV. It was a 3 o'clock kick-off on a Saturday. And Wickham took another gamble of hosting a live screening of the game back at Adams Park in Wickham. So they brought a truck onto the pitch with a supposedly a big screen. If you look at it now, I think, well, that's not that big. But it was at the time, like, there was a few thousand people at the ground was there watching this tie as well. So you were sat at Filbert Street, and then going back to the game where Roy Essendo's come on in the last, he's come on with 15 minutes to go. And then in stoppage time, he's rose like a salmon to head home in the winner. And everyone's gone crazy. Those scenes were replicated back in Wickham as well, because they could see it live. So, and it was shown live outside of the UK. So there's other fans might have seen it if they were outside of the UK, but there was 3,000 in Leicester, and there was 2,000 or 3,000 back at Adams Park watching it. Perhaps some people were following it on teletext as well, because there were live updates of the game on teletext at the time, and sort of refreshing away and waiting for the page to come back round again and say FT, you know. So it's one of those moments. Where were you when Essendo scored the goal?
Yeah, just on the subject of beanbags. I don't know if they were called beanbags at the time.
Yeah, they did call it a beanbag. Yeah, that's good memory.
Yeah, where they show it on the big screen in the crowd. I've been to one of those, but it was only about 5 years ago, so the technology was a lot better. But still, and yet still, there is a big truck that they wheel onto the pitch, and there's a massive television on the side, and every 5 minutes it goes off, and everyone starts going, "Whoa, what's going on?" And it's the horizontal bars because the footage isn't great. But I loved going to that theme back. Going back to the game. Yes, you mentioned Essendo made his entrance in the 74th minute, replacing Keith Ryan. And the stage was set for a magical finish. Now, there is a very famous clip of a jubilant Laurie Sanchez watching Essendo score that winning goal live on a small CRT television in the tunnel. Now, that was because he'd been sent off by the referee for appealing for a penalty. So what do you think? Do you think that should have been a pen? I reckon that with current technology, VAR would probably have awarded that to Wickham. What do you think?
Well, that's open to debate. But if there's someone out there who can understand the current laws on the handball situation on penalties, then, you know, please let us know. Because there's so many bizarre decisions being made, even with multiple angles. I mean, that cross at the time, I can picture it was from the Wickham right wing, and he crossed it and it struck the upper arm of Stephen Oakes, who actually later played for Wickham.
Oh, okay.
I think there was only a couple of angles and they weren't great, but I'm pretty sure it would have been given. Again, I remember looking down at the monitors and thinking, but while we were doing that, Laurie Sanchez was off down the touchline. And if you get onto the internet and find a clip of the game, it's just a classic footage of Laurie Sanchez marching off down the touchline in his Mac, which was his lucky Mac. You know, he didn't wear it just because it looked great, because it certainly didn't. He was absolutely soaked because it was chucking down that day, and he went off and perhaps suggested to the referee that he'd made the wrong decision in the strongest terms that he could come up with, which then resulted with him being sent off down the tunnel. And the secretary of the club at the time, Keith Allen, went down with him to keep him company, and they were in this little room with a closed circuit TV with live pictures of the game. And I could see occasionally that the live feed that I'm guessing Sky were putting together, I think it was Sky who were covering the game for their evening highlights game before match of the day, kept flicking back to the footage of Laurie Sanchez in this room with Keith Allen. Of course, when that happened, Laurie Sanchez and Keith Allen could see themselves on the screen. And Laurie Sanchez wasn't very happy because he wanted to watch the game. He didn't want to watch a picture of himself watching the game. And there was a clip somewhere where he looks angrily at the camera and suggests that they should get the coverage back onto the pitch. And the coverage quickly flashes back to the game. But then when the goal went in, luckily they were recording those pictures all the time, so they could go back to that and get a replay of when the goal went in. And when the goal went in, it was Keith Allen, the secretary, was jumping for joy with his arms up. And Laurie Sanchez just went in a sort of state of shock and marched out the room and down the tunnel just to check that it actually happened, that it wasn't just someone coming up with some spoof footage of Roy Essendo scoring the goal. It's like, what? It's incredible footage. You couldn't If someone wrote that, you could, you know, it'd just be a, you know, it's too far fetched.
Yeah, especially because Laurie Sanchez is watching on his little CRT TV, and considering where this story started on teletext, I think it was somehow so fitting that there's a nice little beginning, a middle and end to the whole Essendo saga, beginning with technology on TV and ending with that.
After one dodgy refereeing decision too many, Sanchez got himself in a spot of trouble.
The referee's come across and sent me off. So I'm spending the last 10 minutes of the game underneath the stand watching a monitor that I think a TV monitor with my secretary, Keith Allen at the time.
Royce knocks it down and away from the point of immediate danger. It is! It's Isando! The player who's only on a week-to-week contract. This is an incredible story.
What was it like to experience that for yourself, being at the ground? Did you celebrate much, or did you keep your professional hat on reporting on the game?
Well, I like to think I kept my professional hat on, having been told to calm down in the previous round against Wimbledon.
What did you get told off by the people in the press box?
Well, I can't remember when I got told to calm down, but it was either the equaliser in the 125th minute or whatever, or the penalty winner. I think it was possibly the equaliser, because I was trying to get a match report out on the final whistle, and I was aware of trying to get home as well from South London. It's not the greatest place to get back to High Wycombe, as anyone ever been to that area of London will know. And I was, as I guess a lot of web reporters were doing, were writing a report on the fly. So I was sort of drafting something out along the lines of Wycombe bow out 2-1, unlucky defeat at Wimbledon, and took them to the death, and was just ready to press that upload button when Paul McCarthy knocked in the equaliser. And I probably let out a cheer or two. And some man in a suit, naughty, naughty, don't do that. And but at Leicester, it was slightly different, because it was outside. It was at Wimbledon, it was inside. You're behind a screen, which I felt was all a bit sort of clinical. I don't remember any other ground that I went to apart from, at Wycombe, it's like that, a very small press box, but you can sit outside. I much prefer to be outside where you can hear the crowd. And it was not the same situation at Leicester. But I think, like I said earlier, when the goal went in, it was more of a sort of shock, really. You think, blimey, does that count? and just seeing the celebrations across the other side of the pitch. Wycombe fans were tucked away on a fairly low roofed area, which they use for away fans for big games. And then Wycombe had some fans behind the goal in the upper tier as well. So you were trying to look at all, you're trying to take it all in. Just checking who scored the goal and what minute it was, and trying to upload perhaps an update or something like that, or make a note of it in your book for later. So I don't remember celebrating it too much, other than looking down in front of me and looking at the rest of the Wycombe sort of press team and looking at each other and thinking, blimey, you know, 2 or 3 minutes time, we could be in a semi-final of the FA Cup. And a bit emotional.
Yeah. It's crazy what emotions football can elicit when it really is just a game, but it's not a game at the same time.
No.
I should imagine that was absolutely wonderful for yourself and an abiding memory for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and for the players as well at the time. You know, that was, it's probably every person in that team, it was probably the highlight of their career up to that point. And along with the semi-final.
Yeah.
Certainly for Roy Essendo.
What was your feeling when you realised that it was Roy Essendo who scored the winning goal?
I think most, like a lot of people, just a total shock, really, because it was an absolutely brilliant header. It was fantastic. You know, it was a real 1960s style header, so I'm told. You know, I can't remember football back that far, but it was just a wonderful header. I can't remember him having a shot on goal before then in any game.
Yeah.
But that's all part of the legend.
The romance is over. Reality returns to the FA Cup in the shape of a really mouth-watering final. It's Arsenal versus Liverpool, but nobody will ever forget the odds-defying cup run of Laurie Sanchez's Wycombe Wanderers.
Well, unfortunately, Wycombe could not progress beyond the semi-final as they lost 2-1 to Liverpool. But a massive following of 20,000 Wanderers fans were treated to a close-ish finish at Villa Park. Well, what are your abiding memories of that day? Do you think that was more memorable or the Essendo match?
Yeah, they were both memorable for their own, you know, for their own reasons. You know, just getting to the semi-final of the FA Cup was, with all the best will in the world, it will possibly never happen again for Wycombe Wanderers. You know, certainly not in recent history. You know, we've not managed to get any further than in the fourth round. So you know, you're there, and it's, you know, you think of abiding memories, then. Again, it's quite a surreal situation to be in, where there's 20,000 fans going to what it feels like a cup final, to be honest. You know, you're going to a neutral ground, you're playing Liverpool, and again, you want to you don't want to come out on the end of a thrashing. When you get there, you're trying to take everything in. You get there as early as you can on the day, have, you know, meeting fans. When I was in the ground, again, I was in the press area, and again, you've got, you know, incredible facilities at Villa Park. Talking of surreal incidents, you know, you're in the press area before the game, and you get cups of tea and cakes. You know, they're like, blimey, this is amazing. And then you're having a cup of tea with Ron Atkinson, who's doing the game as well. He said, my God, you know, what's happened? What's happened here? You know, it was two men and a dog earlier on in the competition when we started off at home to Harrow Borough, back in the November, I think it was, when it started. And
would that have been the first round as well?
Yeah, first round. So we being in the third tier, we were having to go through the earlier stages of the FA Cup. But yeah, the Liverpool game was fantastic. I mean, the Wycombe fans were mostly behind the goal in the whole end. I sat there when they held up they got given coloured cards to hold up, and so the whole end was in a quartered light and dark blue when the teams come on the pitch, and looking across at that, and blimey, you know, this is, you know, again a very emotional day. But Widow, the team took it onto the pitch. You know, they fought until quite late in the game before Liverpool had to bring on the big boys to help them get through, and they got a couple of goals, and looked like we were going out 2-0, which was not a big disappointment. It was to only lose 2-0 to Liverpool, but for then, in the dying stage of the game, for Keith Ryan, one of our makeshift strikers, defender, midfielder, playing where you like, he'll always do a job, to pop up and score was incredible. He played for the club for 10 years. You know, he was signed by Martin O'Neill 10 years previous. And for him to notch the goal against Liverpool and just give that mind, we could get another one here, was an incredible scene. And he scored it at the end where the Wycombe fans were as well. So when he scored, he could celebrate in front of them. But it was very sad at the final whistle. Yeah, mixed emotions, really, hanging around the ground after the game. And it's pretty grim weather that day. But again, you're in a press conference with what seems to be half the world there. I'm talking to Liverpool official Gerard Houllier, the manager at the time, and they're talking about Liverpool, who just played in Europe, I think, a few days beforehand, and talking about them, how they just managed to scrape through against Wycombe Wanderers. And I'm feeling disappointed we've lost against Liverpool in the semi-final of the FA Cup, which is, you're thinking, perhaps we could have sneaked it, you know. Yeah, it was one in a million, I think, that day.
Regarding Roy Essendahl, did he play in the semi-final? I assume he must have.
He came on a sub again. You know, you think, well, we'd bring him on a sub with 15 minutes left. He can score a couple of goals here. But yeah, he didn't that time. But he set his mark in the as a Wickham legend anyway. So, you know, he didn't really have to do a great deal. You can't expect someone to come on again and do the same thing. But
yeah,
if he had done, my God, I don't know what would have happened.
Yeah, incredible. Well, what happened to Essendahl following the Cup exploits? Did he sign a new contract with Wickham to extend his 2 week stay to the end of the season? Did he have any impacts?
Well, yeah, I think up to this day, I've been pretty harsh on Roy Essendahl. So I'll have to...
Considering he's a legend.
Yeah, he did. He was given a contract till the end of the season. And then he left at the end of the season.
Great.
So, yeah. He didn't make any further impact, but he helped us out because we helped us out in numbers, because although he didn't score any more goals, we were drifting away at the bottom of the table and we're trying to pull a few results together just to keep us safe, because we put everything into that cup run. You know, we were playing games where perhaps we could have got them called off just to get players to play, because if they didn't play, they'd be suspended for a cup game. So, you know, we were playing midweek games where it was playing out a couple of players' suspensions. So, you know, if he wasn't with us, then we would have been struggling for numbers. It was getting to that point.
So what happened that season? Did you manage to stay up? Or...
Yeah, we stayed up. We signed a few other temporary players. I think it was Guy Whittingham we signed.
I remember him, yeah.
He played for Portsmouth, and we managed to scrape a win. We got a win at Bristol City. I think it was on Easter Monday. And I'm not sure if that confirmed our safety, but it was, you know, I think we're pretty much safe now. We got enough points together and we were comfortably safe by the end of the season. Yeah, we won a few other games. So, you know, looking at the final table, you probably thought, there was never in any danger. But, you know, you never know when you start losing games, you know, things can go wrong. But, you know, we managed to pull some results out of the bag and hang in there. We had a decent season the next season as well, because we had a little bit of money from the cup run. Back then, the FA Cup wasn't worth anywhere near as much as it is now. But we invested a bit of the money in two or three players, and we had a fairly reasonable season the following season, finishing in the top half of the third tier, and also picking up a fair bit of support as well. Our average gate probably went up about 1,000 or so as a result of the cup run, which doesn't sound a lot, but 1,000 at that level to pick up is a big number, you know, when you multiply it by however much you're paying to get in at the time over the course of the season.
Well, I'm a Wigan supporter, and at that time, 2001, we would have only had 1,000 to 2,000 people come into the games when I first started going watching them. And they were around about the same level of league football as Wigan Wanderers at the time. So that sort of gives it some sort of perspective, I think, whereas Premier League teams would have been pulling in 60, 70,000 or whatever.
Yeah. Wigan were in the same division at the time, and they were coming through the ranks because of the behind-the-scenes investment at Wigan. You know, they got a new ground in the late 1990s, because, you know, when Wigan went in the Football League, we played Wigan at the old ground, and then a couple of seasons later, we crossed paths again, and they were in the new ground, and they were sort of edging up. You know, you could see they were investing money in players, and over the course of time, of course, you remember Wigan as being that team that got to the Premier League. And you know, similar that season, Wigan were playing Bournemouth in the league, and you would never imagine Bournemouth being in the Premier League. You know, they dropped down again now, but you know, they were in the Premier League for a number of seasons. And you could never see Bournemouth challenging. But again, there was, you know, things don't happen at that sort of level without some money being pumped into the club. But yeah. It's interesting looking back on the teams you're playing. You know, there's obviously teams that have gone in the opposite direction as well.
Teams that might not be in existence anymore.
Yeah, I'm just trying. I'm thinking of Stockport County, but I don't think we played them. I don't think they're in the league that season. I think they were perhaps they were in a division above. I'm not sure. I'd have to look at that. But I mean, I don't think we played them that season. But you know, Stockport County weren't at that time. We were playing Stockport. It was a strong club, and they drifted down out into non-league football. And yeah, sad to see some of these clubs not disappear. I mean, because the main thing is they're still going in some form. But certainly, you know, someone like Bury, for example, we certainly played Bury that season. And what's happened to Bury is you know, nothing short of disgraceful.
Yeah, it's perilous. It's a perilous situation, even for people like Bolton. Were they in the Championship when they went into admin? So were Wigan, actually. And you've got these second division teams only in the second tier. Well, nobody's safe, basically, now. With Wigan, we were fine one day. Then the next day, we were notified that we were in administration, which is insane. Yeah. Whereas normally you'd think there's a big build-up to that. Oh, we're running out of money. That things are looking tight. Now, it can just be one day the rug's pulled out from under you. Things are never the same. But the money that's involved now, the money that has to be pumped into a club to get them from lower league up to the Premier League is crazy. And if you look at teams like Salford and Fylde, who are a couple of local teams to me who've got angel investors that want to come in and try and fund the rise through the leagues, it's going to be so difficult for them. How much money do you think that the millions and billions that they're going to have to pump into that to just to subsidize them getting up to the Premier League?
Yeah. The phrase that often comes out is vanity projects on those sort of things. You know, it's those clubs are putting all their eggs in one basket. They're going down the route of letting them be run by multimillionaires. And it's quite easy further down the line where they haven't quite succeeded in getting to the holy grail of Championship or the Premier League, where there's millions of pounds to be made per game rather than per season, and they suddenly, well, I'm bored here, or I've got a better offer from another club, and then the club's left to sort of pick up the pieces, and it's usually down to the same people, you know, be it supporters, trust groups or whatever, to try and resurrect something on what's been left by the financial disaster that they've left the club in.
I guess that's kind of the state of football nowadays, and it has changed a lot since the days of Wycombe Wanderers' FA Cup exploits. Things have come a long way. There's so much more money involved. The Premier League has become richer, and the lower league teams have become only a little bit richer.
So
lots and lots has changed in the last 20 years, but I think even today, the concept of a football team posting a striker wanted advertisement on teletext is quite a novel one. And maybe that's just another of those things that makes the SNO story unique. Now, I don't know if you're aware, Paul, but there is a community of teletext archaeologists, as they dub themselves, who search for teletext pages on old VHS and Betamax videotapes. And now to date, well, I've been consulting with the team this week. To date, we actually haven't uncovered the SNO article or page on CFAX. But I think with the number of tapes that we keep getting donated, it's likely that at some point we will probably stumble across it. I've notified the guys of this. They know about this story now, and they will look for it in the future. So, yeah. What do you think about that? What do you think about the idea of teletext archaeology?
Well, being an avid historian of football and music history as well, live music history, it's anything that you can find which, you know, hasn't been found before or been documented away in a newspaper archive on microfilm or whatever is amazing to find. But I say wasn't aware that you could get teletext from old VHS tapes, although I do remember accidentally hitting a teletext the text button on a remote control while playing a VHS tape and it coming up with some sort of garbled teletext, which appeared to be from the time. So without getting sort of too much wrapped up in the technology, are you saying that a tape from the time would be able to, you'd be able to view all the teletext pages from the time?
Yeah, depending on how good quality the recording is.
Mm.
Because of the way teletext was broadcast, it was broadcast with the television broadcast.
Mm.
Yeah, you can recover that data from tape. If you, say, recorded a match off the TV, you could get the teletext that was broadcast alongside that.
Blimey.
With a program called Teletext to VHS.
Blimey.
VHS to teletext. Got to get that right. Yeah.
Well, knowing of some historians, I could probably find some tapes, no doubt, that you might help you out. Being someone of that nature who collects tapes or have kept tapes from many years of Wickham games and stuff, then we might be able to help you out.
Oh, excellent. Well, there is a growing community of people who are doing this. Yeah, I have to say, it still amazes me when I think about it that you can do that, that you can get teletext from VHS tapes.
Yeah, I think where you can find a story that's not anywhere else, you know, if it's just data of football scores and things like that, it's nice to see it from a nostalgia point of view. But if certainly I was talking earlier, maybe there's an interview with a footballer or I'll say there's a lot of music stuff on teletext as well. There might be interviews with bands because there was sort of indie music teletext pages. Yeah, possibly the only copy of that exists is sitting on a tape somewhere, which is most likely just get thrown away because it's only, you know, someone recorded some afternoon TV program to watch later and stuck it in a cupboard somewhere, ready to be thrown in a skip.
Yeah. Well, save those tapes. They are little teletext time machines.
Blimey.
So, Paul Lewis, thank you very much for being a guest on this episode of the Teletext R podcast.
No worries. It's been great talking, reliving those memories. And good luck with your search for the archives. And hopefully one day that S&O story will turn up and we can put it on the internet where it belongs. We're in its rightful place. We can finally put it on the official website.
Yes. Hey, maybe we could send it to them. Are you still in contact with the official website? Do you still do stuff with them?
No, I'm in contact with them. We all get along. We're all a happy family. You know, it's a small club. It's a relatively small club, knowing that the official site now is very much official, the official line and everything, but there's always room for an independent website who can just take a slightly different angle on things. And although my own site now is more of an historical reference and in trying to remain up to date with match reports, so I've gone down the Twitter route to post stuff on a daily basis, be it looking back on games in the past or just posting up match news on the day and just a few random thoughts as you do on Twitter. You can get that via the website, the link. It's chairboys.co.uk is the website. There's a link to Twitter on there.
Fantastic. And I do recommend following Paul, especially if you're a fan of Wickham Wanderers. In fact, if you are, why aren't you following him already? But yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. I've just got one more question, though. In the press box, did you actually get teletext?
No, there was no screen. There was no TV screen in the area I was in. It's quite a small area. I believe there was one screen, TV screen, in the main announcers part of the press area where they could look at final score and possibly teletext, but there was no direct access. There's still no monitors as such at Wickham.
Right.
That's something you only ever get at the perhaps newly built ground. I know Brentford's got that in their new ground. Certainly at the sort of championship second tier level, you're looking at teams that are ex Premier League because maybe it's a requirement of the Premier League that you must have monitors built in. But no teletext.
Oh.
Not for me anyway, because I had to wait till I get home.
Oh, right. So thank you very much for your contributions today, Paul.
No problem.
But there's only one more thing to say on this episode of the Teletext Star podcast, and that's keep it blocky. So that's our catchphrase, you see, that we always say. Was there anything else you wanted to say?
Well, great to have a chat about that. It's a lot of memories. That period in time for Wickham was an incredible time to be involved with the club website as well. It was just lucky for me that I was doing the website. That was the only season that I did the website as a complete season. So if you're going to pick a season to have to do the official website, then that would probably be the one looking back on it. But you never knew at the start of that season that it was going to unravel into reaching the FA Cup semi-final. So that's something I always look back on as being, well, blimey. I was there every game and doing the official website. So, you know, I had a cup of tea with Ron Atkinson one day.
It's serendipitous, isn't it? Like most of these stories, like most of the FA Cup stories, you never sit down at the beginning of the season and say, right, this is the season we're going to get to the semi-final or whatever.
Yeah, the other thing I'd say, Dan, is this is interesting that you talked about the way that the story has changed over time. I remember at the time where, I can't remember the sort of the percentages involved, but sort of, let's say half and half, some of the press went down the teletext route and some went down the internet route on how it was posted. Or they found the striker, basically, I suppose, to fit their own agenda and headlines. And perhaps they didn't think it was even possible that someone had posted something on teletext, and surely it must have been on their website because that would have been the modern day way of doing things. So you saw a few headlines that were based around the player being signed on the internet. The most fantastic headline that I saw, which was factually incorrect, was essendolastminute.com, which I thought was a great headline, but also wound me up at the same time.
Yeah, the BBC article that they wrote at the time described Essendo as a Cyberman. In time, history has seemed to warp that into the CFAX man. But maybe that's more because that's more factually correct.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
And for example, the FA did a video feature, which you can find on YouTube on Roy Essendo, the CFAX striker, where I stole that name from, basically. In that, does he mention teletext? I think he says that it was on teletext and doesn't mention anything about the official website. So maybe the real story is coming out over time. When they talk to Sanchez and when they talk to Essendo, the actual facts are shining through now, free of this idea of having to write a headline. Because I don't know, I think it's a more appealing headline in the year 2021 to say that it was teletext rather than the internet, because teletext is now considered archaic and old, and there's that charm to it. What do you think?
Yeah, like I think over time, people like myself and Laurie Sanchez have been interviewed, and the press officer, Alan Hutchinson, at the time has been interviewed, and gradually people have become aware, look, it was teletext. It wasn't on the website. And so that's how it's become. It's taken 20 years to get there, but we've finally got there. The facts are there. But yeah, at the time it was something that the press picked up on. They've got, you know, minutes to put headlines together for a printed publication to be printed on a Saturday evening. So they just went with something that looked good.
Yeah. I mean, if it did eventually get posted on the message boards, I suppose it isn't entirely incorrect that it was on there as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was definitely reported on the internet, but it was reported that it had been on teletext. It's a fantastic story. The fact is, he could have done nothing in that game. Someone else could have scored a winner. We could have got to the semi-final, and it would still have been a fantastic day. But the fact that Roy Essendo scored the goal just makes that whole story just something else. It takes it to a completely different level. You know, probably stuff films are made of.
Yeah, it's, well, I think it's quite funny that they haven't made a film based on it, or even a documentary, which might be more appropriate. Maybe I'm shocked to learn that after 20 years, nobody's working on that. Maybe the 25th anniversary.
There's quite a lot of footage, behind the scenes footage that was taken by one of our players as well. Steve Brown took a lot of camcorder footage in the dressing room, which some of it's been broadcast on national TV, but some of it might still exist unbroadcast. And there's like team talks as well. I remember hearing a recording of the team talk that Laurie Sanchez made at the semi-final, which was extraordinary team talk with, blimey, you know, they could win this. If you were sat there as a player, you'd think we can win it, you know, and that's the sort of team talk you want.
He's managed all sorts of people, hasn't he? Did he manage Ireland or was it Northern Ireland?
Yeah, he did. They beat England.
Yeah. Okay.
At the time, so yeah, it was. It's pretty difficult to get on with, I should imagine. I mean, I didn't really get on with him. I didn't need to get on with him because I didn't have contact with him on a daily basis. But right. From what I understand, he was difficult to get on with. You know, he had his own ways of working, and he was pretty dour sort of character.
Right. Okay.
So, but you know, he did his job, and he'll be remembered for taking Wickham to the semi-final. So Laurie Sanchez was a fairly dour character, but he got the best out of the players, and he had every confidence in them, and he obviously made some fairly motivational team talks. But I do remember after the Leicester game, where we just reached the semi-final of the FA Cup, and I had a few minutes to spare to go into the press conference after the game because I was getting a train back to London. I had sort of half an hour to spare, so I'm going to get in the press conference. And they asked Laurie Sanchez his feelings on reaching the semi-final of the FA Cup. And one of his first comments was that the linesman had almost cost the club X amount of £1,000 for not giving a penalty. You know, we've reached the semi-final. You know, it's, you know, celebrate that. And then perhaps, you know, that was just the way he was. You know, he had his own ways. You couldn't argue with the results that he got to get us to the semi-final of the FA Cup.
Did you ever interview Sanchez?
No, not directly. I mean, in the short time I was at the club, I was involved in press conferences after the game where the press would ask questions.
Yes.
As the FA Cup went on, there was just multiple reporters there who were asking questions. You didn't need to ask anything, but you know, if you rewind that to earlier games where you're playing, I don't know, Cambridge at home midweek, having lost 2-0, and there's like two or three people there, and he's there, he's not very happy. And you think, well, you know, what shall I ask here? You know, or they're waiting for the press to ask something, the local press, and the questions dry up, and you think, well, shall I say something or not? You know, you might get your head bitten off, you know. And he said what he thought, basically.
Did you ever speak to Roy Essendo?
Well, no, I didn't. It's funny, again, after the Leicester game, he was so difficult to get hold of because his agent literally just pulled him away and wanted all the press coverage to be sort of controlled, if you like, for him to try and get a better contract somewhere, you know, for Wickham or another club.
It's these surroundings of Ryman League football that week in, week out, Bishop Stortford's players are familiar with. Most of them have never before experienced the FA Cup. This man has, though.
It's Isando, the player who's only on a week-to-week contract.
Even people in the streets still talk about it and ask you how it was and what it was like and rah, rah, rah. But it was good.
Roy Isando, or Essendo if you prefer. Well, maybe he'll make the headlines again today. He plays for Bishop Stortford in their cup game at Mansfield.
Essendo did go on to play for lots and lots and lots of clubs after that, maybe 20 more clubs.
Oh, right. Blimey.
A true journeyman of the modern age.
Yeah, I mean, he came to Wickham having been in Finland, but he had been in England since for a few months, playing at other clubs. I think he played briefly at Luton Town, and he played at Rushden and Diamonds briefly as well on trial for them in perhaps reserve games or lower level competition before he had a go at Wickham. He did well, you know, he scored a goal in the FA Cup and got a contract at the end of the season. I didn't really follow his career that much afterwards, but most of the times I saw him afterwards when Wickham were in the FA Cup again, and they got him back in the studio as a pundit, if you like. You know, here's Roy Essendon, he scored the goal that took Wickham to the semi-final of the FA Cup.
Look at that, he's living off that, basically living off that moment. Yeah. Well, I'm looking at his career. He went on to play for Barnet, Cambridge, Bishop Stortford, which he stayed at for the longest, over 150 games for them. Then Billericay Town, Bishop Stortford again, Kettering, back to Bishop Stortford, where he stayed for a long time. And then he moved to Northern Ireland, a couple of teams in Northern Ireland, Glenavon, St. Neots Town.
Yeah.
Then back to England. So, yeah, his agent must have done a great job in toting him up to all these different teams. He must have said, this is the guy that was on Teletext. Do you remember that? When he scored against Leicester in the FA Cup quarterfinal. This is the guy you want to bring in for three games. For Bishop Stortford, he played, well, in his final stint, 149 times with 62 goals. So I think that was his level.
Blimey. Bishop's, I mean, Wickham played Bishop Stortford in league games in the 70s and 1980s before they got into what's now the National League and the Football League. Bishop Stortford had a few FA Cup runs. It rings a bell that maybe Bishop Stortford got to the more advanced stages of the FA Cup for a non-league team, like the first, second round, maybe third round at one point, perhaps with Essendon playing. You'd have to check that.
Wickham are looking for a winning goal here at Filbert Street. Royce knocks it down and away from the point of immediate danger. It is! It's Essendon! The player who's only on a week-to-week contract. This is an incredible story. And Roy Essendon has stepped from obscurity into international headlines.